Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 60 of the Alabama Liberal Podcast, the Big 6-0, and of course, 60 is the new 50. Now, those of you who listen to the first 50 or so episodes, you know that every fifth episode, I like to do a little bit of predictions, some of which turn out pretty good. But this episode's going to be about the Senate and about the effort to take back the Senate, and can we do it? Can we flip the Senate? Can we take it back? I don't want to give it away because, you know, this is a long podcast, so I don't want to give away the ghost in the first minute of it, but I think our odds are looking better every single day. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to run through each individual Senate race that's taken place this year and kind of say the odds of flipping it. Right now there are 23 seats held by Republicans that are up in November and only 12 seats held by Democrats. The odds are certainly in our favor, especially the coronavirus, the pandemic, the terrible response to that by Trump and several of the senators, which we're definitely going to get into that, of course. You have to flip three seats just to tie Joe Biden. He'll pick a Democratic vice president, of course. It'd be insane if he didn't. It's a tie in the Senate, then it goes up to the vice president. The vice president breaks a tie, so essentially Democrats will have control in the Senate. But the problem is, you really need to be able to flip four for multiple reasons. Number one, you don't know if Doug Jones, my man Doug Jones, and it would be heartbreaking if he lost, but you don't know if Doug Jones is going to be able to hang on to his Senate seat. So then you need to be able to flip four just in case he loses. Also, there's some people like Joe Manchin that no matter what you're trying to pass, they may not vote for it. So you have to be prepared for a few Democratic holdouts. There's also Bernie Sanders, because keep in mind, now you may look at it on, well now wait a minute, 53 Republicans and you're saying 47 Democrats, but there's only listed as 45 Democrats. That's because of Angus King and Bernie Sanders. Angus King, the senator from Maine, he caucuses with Democrats, but he's not one of them. He's an independent. Bernie Sanders is also somebody who caucuses with Democrats, but famously is not a Democrat, even though it's confusing because he's running for the Democratic nomination in 2020. So I know that's a little bit weird. Bernie Sanders, you know, he's not going to be the nominee, but he's going to be in the Senate for another 4 years. So you got to think, he's voted no on a lot of stuff that Democrats have wanted to do. Sensible immigration reform. Biden famously hits him for the gun bills over and over again, but there's been a whole bunch of stuff like moderate immigration reform. He's not really for that. I think closetly, he doesn't care that much for immigrants, even though he won't say it out loud. And something like Obamacare, it's like, well, it doesn't go far enough. And it's like, yeah, we know, Bernie, you want to go really, really, really far and have a bill that can't pass. So you got to be prepared for a holdout like Bernie Sanders, who's just bitter that he didn't win, is going to vote no and everything. You got to be prepared for somebody like Joe Manchin, who's basically subsidized by the coal companies. I mean, if he opened his mouth and a lump of coal fell out, that would be more subtle than what he's been doing. So he's going to vote no on any kind of environmental proposals. And then you got to be prepared for something like Doug Jones, where he could very well lose. So I think you need at least four. It'd be great if you got five. That may be a little bit unrealistic, although it's becoming more realistic every single day. You've been paying attention to polls, but since this crisis broke through, people like Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell, who were in safe Republican seats, they're now leaning Republican. On Wikipedia, there's safe R. Safe R means solid Republican. You can't beat them. That's something like Arkansas. Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton literally has no opposition. About the only way he could lose is if he died, right? Like that, like caught coronavirus from Rand Paul and passed away. But about the only way he could lose. Then you got a seat like Wyoming. In Wyoming, Mike Enzi, the longtime Republican senator from Wyoming, he's retiring. So you might think, well, that's a good seat for a toss-up, except that it's in fucking Wyoming. Wyoming is notoriously Republican. I mean, probably, I say 10 times more so than Alabama is. Like, it's Dick Cheney's home state. I didn't actually know that until I watched that movie Vice, where Christian Bale played Dick Cheney, because I guess I figured Dick Cheney was egg-hatched or from some primordial ooze or something like that. I didn't know he was born anywhere, but I guess he's from Wyoming originally. You have a state like Idaho. These are seats that there's just absolutely no way that Democrats are going to be able to flip those, and that's okay because we don't need all of them to flip. Like I said, five would absolutely do the trick. So let's run through a few of these Senate races. And also, the interesting thing is that every single day, there's more scandals developing. Every single day, the Republican Senate looks worse and worse. Lindsey Graham, Tucker Carlson called him out. I mean, this last week, I mean, it might truly be the end of the fucking world because Tucker Carlson was right twice. I agreed with him twice, so I'm like, oh my God. Sarah Palin's dancing as a bear to Baby Got Back on Masked Singer, and Tucker Carlson's been right twice. Like, it truly is the end times. Please go buy gold and canned goods as fast as you can. Tucker Carlson calling out Lindsey Graham saying, hey, he's for these EB-5 visas for more Chinese people. Here's the thing about the coronavirus. People are losing their minds. Anytime you call it the Wuhan flu or the Chinese virus, or even point out, as I have many times on Twitter, here. China lied about the spread of this disease for months. They've known about it since November. Now, I know people say December. It's actually been November. They've known about this. They actively suppressed information. They lied about it. They weren't ringing the alarm bells, and that's why the globe is shut down. The Ebola virus was 10 times deadlier of a virus than the coronavirus has been, but the countries where it originated, they didn't lie about it. They didn't actively say, it's not happening. A doctor said that it's happening. Let's jail him. Since November, this virus has been spreading around China, and I know that because my wife travels to China a lot for business, and they were supposed to go last December, and even back then, they were like, you might want to push that back. There's a lot of people getting sick. She actually went to China in January, and I remember the exact dates because I'm watching two small kids by myself. I'm like, okay, January the 4th to the 15th is etched in my mind. So she's there for 2 weeks on a business trip, and even at that time, people are saying, hey, avoid large crowds, wear a face mask, don't go out. A lot of people are getting sick. Luckily, she avoided it. They've known about this for several months. Just admitting that China lied about it, you say something like that on Twitter, and it goes over like a wet fart. I mean, nobody wants to hear it. Nobody's like, this is Trump's fault. This is his disease. This is his virus. Trump's handling has been terrible. He was terrified it would taint the economy. But what he's done is not unexpected. I mean, it's exactly how you would expect him to handle a crisis, which is incompetent, fearful, afraid. NBC reporter a few days ago asked him, he said, what would you say to Americans who were scared about this virus? I would say you're a terrible reporter, lashed out at him. When he started speaking, the market was up 200 points. By the time he got done, it was down 400 points. You know, the market tanks. I mean, every time he gives press conferences, rumors, you know, we don't really know about this is true, but it sounds true, that he's jealous that Andrew Cuomo is getting a lot of press coverage for his treatment of the virus and stuff. We've seen him at the CDC making an ass out of himself. He's wearing a Make America Great hat at a virus briefing, and it's like, wow, what a branding opportunity. You want people to associate your brand with the end of the fucking world, with a plague. There's no question that his handling of this has been terrible. It has not been transparent. He's been afraid that it'll take the economy. And of course, no surprise, it winds up taking the economy 10 times worse than if he'd been open and transparent about it to begin with. They may have to give every individual American $1,200 checks. That's what some people want to do. Bernie Sanders wants to do $2,000 checks per month, every month that this crisis goes on. Other people want a permanent universal basic income. So this is going to be 10 times more expensive than if he'd just been transparent to begin with. No, it's not saying that Trump has handled this crisis well, but he's handled it inside the United States. He doesn't control the World Health Organization. So when you hear all these people being like, Trump's responsible for this being a pandemic, I'm sorry, but that's bullshit. He doesn't control the morgues overflowing in Italy because the World Health Organization has been lied to by China for months. He doesn't control Iran's response to this. Iran doesn't trust the United States. We have no influence inside of Iran. They wouldn't believe a word we said, even if we told them it was a pandemic. And they've had the third most fatalities because China was lying to them. China first imprisoned anybody who talked about this disease and this virus, and they said, oh, you shouldn't have been saying that. You're trying to embarrass the Communist Party. And then started spreading a bullshit rumor, which a lot of people on Twitter seem to believe this, that the American military went to China and actively spread this virus. It's been weaponized there. I'm like, oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Italy has more fatalities than China does, even though it originated in China and they have 20 times the population. And the United States, our economy is devastated because we totally weren't prepared for this virus. But that makes sense that we would send it there, weaponize it, actively release it, even though we ourselves were grossly unprepared for it, incompetent, and it's going to cost us trillions dollars to get out of this. That makes a lot of sense if you really think about it, right? No, it doesn't. This is China's fault. It's a disease that started there. They didn't contain it. They actively lied about it. They let it spread. And now the countries they don't get along with so well, Europe and South Korea, Japan, and the United States, our economies have been absolutely devastated. Meanwhile, the 14 countries that have borders with them, they've been barely affected. Russia's had supposedly less than 200 cases as of right now. So you might look at that and think, something don't quite smell right about that. Maybe they were being transparent with some countries and telling them the truth. Maybe they were lying to others. Who knows exactly? But either way you look at it, it reminds me of Chernobyl, the fantastic HBO miniseries that came out last year. But it was all about some people inside the Ukraine. They were trying to do the right thing. And this is back when Ukraine was a part of the Soviet Union and really puppet state of Russia. And part of why they didn't want to be anymore was the response to Chernobyl. Some of the scientists kept saying, hey, you're not being transparent. You're lying to people. We have to get people evacuated. We have to tell them what's going on. We have to find out the real cause of this nuclear disaster. Telling Skarsgård character, he says, you can't embarrass a government that is obsessed with not being embarrassed. They do not want to be embarrassed on the world stage. Nothing like this can ever happen here. Communism is wonderful. It's perfect. There was a great novel novel Child 44 about a serial killer in Russia back during the Stalin era, and they said, oh, no, no, serial killers can't happen here because this is paradise. No, nothing like that could ever happen. So over and over again with communism, you see people denying reality. They don't want to believe that what's happening is actually happening. And that mentality has led China to deliberately lie and actively suppress information about the coronavirus. The same thing as Chernobyl. And of course, people point out, but Trump's done the same thing because Trump is not democratic. I've called him an aspiring tyrant many times on this podcast. He is. That's why we can't have him there. That's why he has to go. Weird thing that Republicans used to really hate communism, even though they were a little bit like that. Reagan famously wasn't transparent about a lot of his scandals. Bush, he totally fucked up the handling of Hurricane Katrina during 9/11. They told him the country's been attacked. He sat there for 6 minutes listening to My Pet Goat, didn't have any kind of reaction time. They said Afghanistan attacked us on 9/11. He says, what about Iraq? We got to go to Iraq. Richard Clark famously said, but Iraq had nothing to do with this, and that didn't make any difference. We are seeing a typical Republican response. In a crisis, they suck. And this is kind of the way that it flows. Democrats come in a Republican crisis. Bill Clinton came in. George H.W. Bush had just had a recession. So he comes in. For 8 years, we have peace and prosperity and a booming economy. He leaves with a budget surplus. 2000, George W. Bush comes in, immediately squanders the budget surplus on a tax cut that we don't need. 9/11 happens. Clinton left him with all kind of memos. Osama bin Laden's determined to attack. He didn't take it seriously, didn't really care about it. Then creates Homeland Security and wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Medicare Part D squanders trillions and trillions of dollars. No surprise, Obama comes in 2008. There's a recession raging. There's a totally unsustainable budget that Bush has exploded. There's all these tax cuts, things like that. Obama spends the majority of his first term just putting out Bush's fires. But here's what always happens. People have a Democratic president for 8 years. They get bored. They're like, hey, there's been peace and prosperity and no major shit going down. They put out all the fires from the Bush era. Let's take a flyer on Trump. No surprise, here Trump comes. Now we're going to be in the middle of a goddamn recession because he's handled something so poorly, and President Joe Biden will spend the majority of his first term just putting out Trump's fires. This has been happening like this over and over again. People get a Democratic president and things are so good for so long, they get bored and they go back to the other side. And then it's like, oh, wait a minute, we forgot. Republicans are fucking terrible at governing and being president. Not just being president, but being senators. This week alone, we've seen Tucker Carlson call out Lindsey Graham for trying to promote more EB-5 visas from China, which makes no sense because those are several people that are connected to the Chinese government. At the same time, seems to be the leading opponent for these stimulus checks. He doesn't want Americans to get stimulus relief money, even though a lot of people actually really need it. It's revealing about Trump that for several weeks, he was talking about a payroll tax cut. But if you're a bartender or a movie theater employee or a waiter or waitress, a lot of Americans get paid daily. If you work at Walmart and you don't show up to work that day, you don't get paid. Meaning you're not on salary. You only get paid if you show up to work. And that's construction, that's retail, that's trucking. That's a lot of different jobs that are affected by that. So if you literally can't come to work, what the fuck good is a payroll tax cut when you're not earning a paycheck anyway? I mean, that literally just seems like it would go to people that don't need it at a time of crisis. So he's torn between a payroll tax cut, which nobody was like, that's just absolutely asinine. That's like saying, hey, the bubonic plague is coming. You know what we got to do? We got to cut home property tax, because that's going to get rid of it. So then finally, I think they talked him into like, hey, Americans need a direct stimulus check. The amount I've heard most often is $1,000, sometimes $1,200. Some people say they want $2,000. Some people want less than that. Lindsey Graham seems to want nothing. But Graham is up for election this year. He could very well lose. God, I hope he does. I really, really, really hope he does. But he's up against a wonderful candidate the Democrats have called Jamie Harrison, and he could lose to him. Then you have Mitch McConnell himself. Now, the first week of this crisis was going on, Nancy Pelosi's House had passed a bill, and McConnell was like, well, we'll vote on it sometime next week. The Senate needs a vacation. We need to... I think he went home or went wherever he goes when the Senate's on break. I assume Satan's cave or lair. He goes to hang upside down in a Koch brother cave or something like that by his feet. And I think you saw the poll numbers that were like, your constituents don't like that, Mitch, and you're up for election this year, and there's some pretty good candidates on the Democratic side that could beat you if they're chosen. So I think he looked at that and was like, oh, shit. And then you saw him change the next week. He was like, we got to get these stimulus checks out there, people. It was like, oh, where'd this urgency come from that wasn't there last week while Rome was burning? Then you have people like Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, the senators from Georgia who suck, Richard Burr, James Inhofe, and Ron Johnson from Wisconsin. All these Republican senators, they're caught up in an insider trading scandal. You might look at this crisis and you might think, wait a minute, several Republicans are caught up in an insider trading scandal. And yeah, I know technically Dianne Feinstein is too, although I think hers is a different case. But several Republicans are caught up in an insider trading scandal. You've got Rand Paul testing positive for coronavirus 1 week after his dad, Ron Paul, said coronavirus is a hoax. This is just more of an authoritarian power grab, which of course is crazy because actually the reason this virus has spread so bad inside the United States is because Trump had such a laissez-faire approach. It's because he didn't do what Obama and Chris Christie and some of the people in the Ebola crisis. They didn't want to shut things down. They didn't want to track the virus. They didn't really want to have an administrative state. It was kind of like, well, we'll let each individual state coordinate their response on their own. States' rights doesn't work on something like a virus. Viruses don't respect states' rights. They travel borders freely. They go across the globe. They go from continent to continent, state to state. They spread. So letting each individual state coordinate their own fiefdom is not going to work in something like this that is a true national threat. Ron Paul saying that is actually the exact opposite of what was happening. No surprise. Ron Paul's the guy who's like, you gotta buy gold, gotta buy gold. Talking about the most raging bull market you've ever seen. Gold stayed flat and stagnant. Stocks were raging for about 12 years. You know, that's the thing about these people. Like, you gotta buy gold, you gotta buy gold. Eventually, they'll be right. There will be a crash eventually. But even if you lose 10% of your stocks for a few weeks, it'll still be a way better investment than gold was. I think I saw where if you bought gold back in the 1930s, like $100 worth of gold, you would have had $4,000 today. If you'd have bought stocks at that same time period, you'd have over $100,000. The gold bulls and the stock market bears and the Federal Reserve, they're going to tank the dollar eventually and stuff. Yeah, sure. I guess anything could happen. If you have a retirement of some sort, I don't. I cashed it all out to buy guns with. Rand Paul has the coronavirus. He may have infected all these other Republican senators. Apparently, several of them had lunch with him last week. They may be out of commission for a few days, even though his dad said it was a hoax. Lindsey Graham saying, don't do the stimulus checks. Mitch McConnell's over there, first dragging his feet. Now he's got a fire under his ass, now that he might actually lose. Most of the senators who were against stimulus, Ben Sasse and some others, they're all Republicans. I mean, only Republicans are against this. Then they go back, and even somebody like Susan Collins, not to allow funding for the CDC several years ago. So, I mean, there's all these different things that keep coming back to almost overwhelmingly the Republican Senate and how badly they handle things in the time of crisis. Here's a problem. When people like me are saying China lied to the globe, the only people agreeing with this, liberals look at me like I've literally screamed the N-word in a crowded theater or something. The only people agreeing with this are people like John Cornyn, who you don't want his support. He's out there being like, well, it's because the Chinese eat dogs and bats, and the Chinese would just go around scooping up puppies and eating them in a puppy stew. His idiotic comments, which are not the same as mine, liberals can't seem to hear a distinction between these two different messages. Like I'm saying the Chinese government lied to people for months because they're communist and they're obsessed with not being embarrassed. And he's up there being like, exactly, because they eat puppies and dogs. I'm like, wait a minute, that's not what I'm saying. These different messages, they get kind of rolled up as though they're the same thing. I'm not saying anything necessarily about the Chinese people. It's about their government and their response. I've heard some people say, well, people are targeting Asian Americans. They're saying bad stuff about them. They're saying racist stuff about them. Criticizing a country's government is not the same thing as saying Asian people are more likely to spread the virus. People like John Cornyn, who's also up for election this year, then you have insider trading. You have some senators who don't want to do stimulus, some senators who their past votes are going to come back to haunt them. All of this looks like perfect and ideal conditions for the Democrats to take back the Senate. So let's go ahead and break it down race by race. So in Alabama, you have my man, Doug Jones. And unfortunately, you know, this is before the Alabama runoff. The Alabama runoff is supposed to take place March 31st. It may be pushed back. I'm not sure if they've said anything about it yet, but that's going to be between Jeff Sessions. Good old Jeff Sessions. Can't wait to get him back in there. And Tommy Tuberville, the ex-Auburn football coach. And it's funny because I went to Auburn at the time Tommy Tuberville was the coach. And a lot of people be like, well, you must be for Tuberville because he coached your team. And I'm like, no, because I know that being a football coach is in no way, shape, or form a good qualification to be in the Senate. Now, if you ask me to choose between Jeff Sessions and Tommy Tuberville, if it was only them in the race, I would choose Tommy Tuberville because we don't know exactly how bad he would be, right? We know Jeff Sessions. We know who he is. He's a known quantity. He's horrible on civil rights. He's atrocious on things like marijuana. Alabama shouldn't have a lottery, this and that. Unlike Trump, I think he actually means it. Trump is probably a fucking Satanist. That's the only way to explain his extraordinary stroke of luck despite having no morals whatsoever. But Sessions, I think he actually believes that the right thing is to have draconian marijuana laws and ban pornography and not sell lottery tickets and basically make Alabama a theocracy. And so we know that that's bad. We know he's a bad guy. We know that he hasn't done shit for the state. I don't necessarily like the other Alabama Senator, Richard Shelby. I mean, I really don't like him, but you could point to some things he's done for Huntsville specifically and some other places. He didn't like that Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin, the space company he's building to rival SpaceX, he didn't like that they weren't building anything inside Alabama, which Huntsville's the rocket city. If you have any type of aerospace or space company or things like that, you should have some type of a presence in Huntsville, I think, and so does he. Because he put a lot of pressure on possibly, you know, doing a lot of regulations on Blue Origin and stuff, Jeff Bezos was like, okay, we'll have a few hundred jobs or a few thousand jobs inside Huntsville making a component for our rockets, and that'll maybe get Richard Shelby off our back. I'm not aware of Jeff Sessions doing anything like that or anything for the state. I can't point to shit that he's done for Alabama. Between those two, though, I'm torn because it's on the one hand, it's like, I know if it was just going to be the Republican primary, I'd prefer Tupperville to Sessions. It's almost like who has a better chance of losing to Doug Jones? And that's kind of what I'm really thinking about. On the one hand, you can make a case where Tupperville may be easier for Jones to beat because he's not as well known in the state. He doesn't have the connections. Mitch McConnell and all the other Republican senators, they don't know him like that do Sessions. They're not going to really come to bat for him. On the other hand, you can make a case where Trump has endorsed Tupperville. He clearly has a grudge against Jeff Sessions. You can point to all these things being like, he doesn't like Jeff Sessions. Tupperville's running an ad where Trump is literally quoted saying, having Jeff Sessions as my AG is the worst mistake I ever made. General election in Alabama, all the Republicans, they're going to be showing up to vote for Trump, and it might be a conflict if they're like, hey, we're here to vote for Trump, but should we vote for Jeff Sessions, a guy that we think is responsible for when he recused himself, he allowed the Mueller probe and all these things to go on, and who Trump clearly doesn't like very well. And so that would be a very similar case to how Doug Jones got the seat in the first place, because you had Luther Strange versus Roy Moore. Luther Strange, Trump had endorsed him, and then he lost, and it was clear that Trump wasn't thrilled about Roy Moore. Mitch McConnell and a lot of other people, they weren't really thrilled about Roy Moore, having him in the Senate, making them kind of look crazy and bad every day. Kind of compare it to that, where it was like it was sort of a muted endorsement, a soft endorsement. And that may be the same thing for Jeff Sessions. It's hard to really say, like, who would Doug Jones have a better chance of beating? You could really make a strong case for either one of them. Only thing you could really hope for is if the primary gets really nasty, if Sessions were to lose, he would go out and say a lot of bad stuff about Tupperville. And Bradley Byrne, I mean, he's a total fucking turd, and he's out there still. He's in the House of Representatives. He was one of only 40 House of Representatives members to vote against the House bill for the coronavirus pandemic. One of only 40, and that's exactly why you lost, Bradley Byrne, you piece of shit. People are dying in the streets from coronavirus. I don't care. I don't want to spend $1 million to save all these lives and get people masks and things like that. If Sessions is the nominee, maybe Tupperville and Byrne will be out there trashing him. You know, Trump is going to be very muted in his endorsement and enthusiasm. Or if Tupperville is the nominee, maybe Sessions would be like, well, if he loses, then I can run again in 6 years. But, you know, of course, Sessions is really old. But being fucking old as hell is no longer an impediment to politics. I mean, the Democratic nomination's down between a 79-year-old and a 77-year-old. So you can no longer say that in 6 years, Sessions couldn't run again. So, you know, who knows what exactly people are thinking about that. Either way, it's going to be a tough fight for Doug Jones in November. But the good news is Joe Biden's the nominee. And that's going to really help a lot of these different people, because Biden is a lot more popular in states like Alabama and North Carolina, Georgia, Texas, Arizona, basically the whole fucking country. You know, the only senator you could say that it wouldn't make a difference is the Maine seat, because Bernie Sanders is almost as popular in Maine as Joe Biden is. So I don't know if it'd make a huge difference who the nominee was. Maine and maybe Colorado, you could kind of say like, hey, we might could flip Maine and Colorado even with Bernie Sanders as a nominee, but that's still not going to be enough. And Doug Jones would absolutely lose if Bernie Sanders was the nominee. There's no doubt in my mind. So the good news is Biden is way more popular in the Southeast. And that kind of made me angry with Bernie fans when they're like, well, Biden, he's only, you know, the Confederacy. That's the only place that he does well in is the Confederacy. And really, that's kind of a shitty thing to say, because actually no Democratic president has ever won the White House without at least two southern states. It's never happened. Barack Obama came the closest in 2012, but he still won Virginia and Florida. And in 2008, he won North Carolina too. 2016, Hillary got Virginia, but she didn't get Florida. Biden, he has to keep Virginia, which I think he will, and it would be nice if he could flip either Florida, Georgia, or North Carolina. I mean, that would definitely be nice. Some people think he might flip Texas. I'm a little skeptical of that myself, but yeah, I mean, if he does that, it's almost like, goodbye, Rust Belt. Been nice being forced to go up there and campaign and get your bitter-ass Midwestern votes this whole time, because Texas would be like, okay, game over for Republicans. You have Doug Jones in Alabama, and I do think having Biden, who's more popular with rural voters, black voters, older voters. I mean, this is a lot of the people Doug Jones needs to get. Black women, they said, was a huge group of support for him in the 2017 special election. Black women, like 100%, voted for him over Roy Moore, and they came out in droves. Alabama as a state is more than a quarter black. It's almost 30% black. So you could look at a state like Alabama and say, when minority people don't vote, or they don't feel inspired, or they don't want to vote, or they can't vote. A lot of times there's voter suppression, there's things like that. We've seen that all over the Southeast in particular. And another great call by the Supreme Court, by the way, being like, I don't think the Southeast needs to be punished for their past mistakes. We'll undo that part of the Civil Rights Act. The second they did, we're going to gerrymander the districts. We're going to shut down voting booths near HBCUs and black churches. We're going to make it as hard as we possibly can for black people to vote. In Texas primary, you saw some black people wait 5 hours to cast a vote. So great, brilliant call on that, Supreme Court. Not. But the fact that Biden is popular with the groups Doug Jones needs to get to show up in order to keep his seat, that's a very positive thing for him. And so that makes me think, you've seen that race where it was like likely R, as in it was a likely R going to flip. And then now it's gone down to leaning R. And of course, if things get much worse with the coronavirus and Biden gets even more popular, you're going to see that become a toss-up. So all we ask for is a toss-up. It'll be a close race for Jones, even if he wins, but a toss-up is better than nothing. Then you go to Alaska, where you got Dan Sullivan running for re-election, Republican, not going to flip that one, so no sense really even talking about it. Then you go down to Arizona, and Arizona is a very good chance for us. I think, honestly, the three best seats for us to flip, most likely in terms of, is Arizona, Colorado, and Maine. But in Arizona, you have Martha McSally, has never been elected. She was appointed. Same thing as what's happened in Georgia with Kelly Loeffler. But Martha McSally, she ran a very tough race against Chris Sinema. Sinema, I think I'm saying that right. I'm not 100% sure. But they were neck and neck and neck, and Sinema eventually beat her out. And Martha McSally lost. It was a very close race. So then when somebody had to appoint a Senate seat, the governor of Arizona chose Martha McSally. So she's running for re-election, even though she was never properly elected, and actually she lost her last Senate race. Best of all, she has a very, very tough candidate in Mark Kelly. Mark Kelly is an excellent candidate. For people who may not know, he's the husband of Gabby Giffords, who the Arizona congresswoman who almost died after some lunatic shot her. I don't know, maybe he saw in his Cheerios that day kill Gabby Giffords or whatever the thinking behind that was. And he's an astronaut. He's a hero for space exploration. He's married to an extremely popular congresswoman who was almost assassinated. He's an excellent candidate. He's about the best candidate that they could hope for against an extremely weak, unlikable candidate in Martha McSally. Martha McSally is a jerk. I saw something a month or two ago where some reporter was trying to ask her a question, and she goes, "You're a liberal media hack," or something like that. So this is very typical of Republicans. When they're talking about themselves or something that they personally have gone through, there's tears in their eyes. They're very sympathetic. They're very moving. And she was very moving when she talked about her own ordeals. But they don't quite extend that sympathy to other people who go through something similar. It's like, they could be lying. I don't know. I don't know if I believe it. I feel like a very weak candidate in terms of people in Arizona clearly didn't want her, even though Sinema herself is not like the most natural fit for Arizona. You're talking about a white blonde lady who's bisexual. And I mean, Arizona is like the largest Democratic voting bloc is Latinos. They're looking at her like, what do we have in common? You know, but I mean, so basically you could say that Mark Kelly has a pretty good chance of flipping that. And then when you go down to Arkansas, of course, I said Tom Cotton, he's not even really running for re-election because he played a dirty trick. He waited till the paperwork expired for Democratic candidates to file for office. Then the guy who did and qualified, only one person on the Democratic side. So this guy, Josh Mahoney, a nonprofit executive, former chair of the Fayetteville Airport Commission and nominee for Arkansas's 3rd Congressional District in 2018, he was the only candidate who even qualified to run against him on the Democratic side. And he waited until the paperwork expired and nobody else could file and nobody else could run. Then he had all this blackmail against Josh Mahoney. He had all these files again. And people should look this up because it's kind of interesting. But he waited until the deadline passed, and then he was going to release all this stuff about Josh Mahoney. Then Josh Mahoney he withdrew from the race, and so now Cotton has really no opposition. Both kind of a dirty trick, and I guess maybe a little Machiavellian. You could say there's some genius in that. I mean, for an Arkansas Republican, pretty sneaky, right? Then you go down to Colorado, which is another seat that we're really hoping to flip. And Cory Gardner, he's the Republican senator from Colorado. But Colorado, of course, is a soft blue state that's becoming more solid blue every single day. out of non-coastal America, Minnesota and Colorado were by far the most liberal states. Against him, the likely nominee for the Senate seat is going to be John Hickenlooper. Now, some of you may remember John Hickenlooper. He ran for president along with 25 other people. He was in one of the debates. He pretty much had to drop out almost immediately afterwards or whatever. He kept mixing it up with Sanders, talking about he's too liberal, this and that. All the Sandernistas are like, he's a sellout. He's a Wall Street Dem. He sucks. And I'll admit, John Hickenlooper, he's not my favorite Democrat. I remember a lot of the environmental stuff they were talking about, which I guess I'm probably more liberal on environmental issues than almost anything else, just because it's important. We're going to end the planet. I have small kids. I hope to have grandkids. I don't want it to be like my great-grandkids are sitting there being like, an ocean wave is about to totally lap their house, and they're like, hey, how come nobody ever did anything about this? But I remember whenever they would talk about environmental bills, John Hickenlooper would always throw cold water on it, because he's fracking people and things like that. They're funding him. And he's basically be like, well, as a former scientist, and it'd be like, you were a geologist for an oil company, okay? That's his claim to being a former scientist. He got hired as a geologist for an oil company, so I was kind of like wanting to call bullshit on that. Would I choose John Hickenlooper over Cory Gardner? Abso-fucking-lutely. I mean, absolutely I would, because that's one more Senate seat that Democrats can have. Who knows? Maybe as a Democratic senator, maybe he'll be 10 times more liberal than we think he could be. You see that happen sometimes with people. They're somewhat conservative governors, because in the governorship, you have to, it's hard to get that national Democratic money. It's hard to get Mike Bloomberg to give a shit about a governor's race in Colorado. It's hard to get George Soros to be like, I need to fund the governor's race of Colorado. It's hard to get attention for that. When you're a senator, the races are a little bit more national. They have national consequences, and that can kind of free you up a little bit, because a lot of Democratic donors in Hollywood and some of the liberal hedge fund managers like Tom Steyer or George Soros, they care about your race a lot more than they would as to where you're inside Colorado. It's small ball local politics, and there's fracking and oil interests that definitely don't want a governor who's not friendly to that in the race. He's definitely going to be more liberal than Cory Gardner would be, and he's definitely going to help the Supreme Court picks and things like that that McConnell's Senate will block. So I'm very optimistic that he can beat Cory Gardner, and I hope he does, and I think he will, actually. If I'm really doing my predictions, I'm thinking that Arizona and Colorado and Maine are going to go the right way for us. And then we go down to Delaware. Chris Coons, the famous Delaware senator, he's running for re-election. I don't see how he could lose. I really don't. Things happen, but I doubt it. Then we get down to Georgia, and we got two Georgia seats that are wide open. We got David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler. Now, out of those two seats, I'm thinking Kelly Loeffler is going to be a lot easier to beat. And it's very strange, because on the one hand, Kelly Loeffler is by far going to be easier to beat than David Perdue, and yet the really good candidates are running against David Perdue and not Kelly Loeffler. And I kind of don't understand that, really. For Kelly Loeffler, she's in a very similar position to Martha McSally. She's never won. Actually, she's in an even worse position, because Kelly Loeffler has never won a political race. She's never run for office, and she's never won an office, so this is the first time that she's ever had to run for office before. For those that may not be familiar, I'll just go ahead and catch up to speed on this. Remember the 2018 very contested Georgia election between Stacey Abrams, Brian Kemp, who's now the current governor, and everybody says Brian Kemp cheated because he should have recused himself from his position, which was basically in charge of the voting machines and different things like that inside Georgia. I mean, it was a total conflict of interest to have him leading all these things that would affect the race. Black people in Georgia, they had to wait in astronomical lines. They were suppressed. Thousands of people were stricken from the Georgia voting rolls that probably would have voted for Stacey Abrams around Atlanta and things like that, because the voting machines were just stacked out the door and everything. Meanwhile, rural white parts of Georgia that vote Republican, you could have strolled in and voted in 60 seconds and left. So you have a governor who cheated his way into the office. Then he gets to appoint a senator, and he chooses Kelly Loeffler, who's never run for office, never been in politics, but she has been political in terms of her political campaign contributions. She's given millions of dollars to the RNC and like Mitt Romney's super PAC and things like that. Her political activism exclusively revolves around political contributions and donations. Has she given any money to one of Brian Kemp's super PACs? I'm sure she has, okay? He appoints her to be the senator from Georgia, even though she's a carpetbagger, total carpetbagger. Until she was 30-something years old, she'd never lived in the state of Georgia. She's from Illinois, because you might be looking at that name and saying, Loeffler, what the hell kind of name is that, right? She's from Illinois. She's from the Midwest. She's born and raised in Illinois. She's rich. She's married to the literal chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, a guy who is ugly and old and bald and short and fat. But hey, he's rich, right? So that's kind of a careerist move in terms of a woman who's literally probably 6 inches taller than this guy is if you see them together, and kind of like, okay, so we know what that's all about, right? We see Melania doing something similar to that. Marries this guy for money, probably not love. He's a very rich guy. She's very rich. She doesn't move to Georgia until she's in her 30s, and that was only for a job, a very well-paying financial job. So in my opinion, I hate people like this. They're total carpetbaggers. They really don't need to be running the Southeast, an area that they don't understand very well. She's now having to run for re-election as an incumbent, even though she was appointed by a governor who cheated. Now, some of you may be getting flashbacks to Robert Bentley in Alabama and Luther Strange and that whole ordeal, where Bentley literally puts up Luther Strange to fill Jeff Sessions' Senate seat because Luther Strange is the Attorney General of Alabama and he doesn't want Strange to prosecute him for misconduct. Then when Strange loses, not long after that, Bentley is basically like, yeah, I better resign because I have no political cover anymore, right? Very similar to what's happened with Brian Kemp. He's appointed somebody who bought their way into the office by hook or by crook, and now they're having to run for re-election, and they will most likely lose. In her primary, she's up against Doug Collins. For those that may not be familiar, Doug Collins is a House of Representatives crazy man who is one of the top Trump backers. He's absolutely gaga for Trump. He's crazy. And so Democrats are in a pretty good position here because it's like, on the one hand, you've got Kelly Loeffler, who, like I said, she's caught up in an insider trading scandal. Right when she was briefed on the coronavirus, her first response was to go tell her husband, and she's saying she didn't do this, but there's no fucking way she didn't do it. She went and told her husband, and he dumped a shitload of stocks, millions of dollars worth of stocks, right before the coronavirus hits. A blonde woman who's never won a race, who people say bought her Senate seat in the first place, and now she's accused of insider trading. I mean, and if you look at her, she looks like a villain straight out of Central Casting. The blonde girl that's the bad guy in the high school movie or whatever, you know? Like, if there's a movie about a fraternity, and it's like, oh, Emma Stone is the good girl that the hero should go for, but he's in love with Kelly Loeffler, and then he finds out, you know, how evil she is in the end or whatever. I mean, she could be like Ann Coulter's younger sisters. She's right out of Central Casting in terms of that blonde mean girl that nobody likes. And she seems like a very unpopular candidate. But Doug Collins, he could beat her in the Republican primary, and that might be good for Democrats, and that he's fucking nuts, and a lot of people don't like him. I think Loeffler would be easier to beat, so I kind of hope, a lot of people are saying she might resign, and Doug Collins would be the candidate in November or whatever. I mean, might resign, hell, she might be arrested. I mean, this is insider trading. Congress used to be able to do stuff like this, but they put so much emphasis on how illegal it is for congressmen to use their knowledge of what's going to happen to trade stocks and everything else. They kind of forced Nancy Pelosi to pass a bill against this a few years ago. So now it's the same insider trading laws for them as it is for us, right? Cory Booker's even come out and said that really senators shouldn't own individual stocks. If they want to own an ETF or a mutual fund that like the S&P index, if they want to say like, hey, I'm just going to track the S&P index, and as long as overall the stocks are going up, that's fine. But owning an individual stock and individual companies, he's saying that really shouldn't even be allowed and they shouldn't do it. And you can kind of see Richard Burr, right? The North Carolina senator we're going to get to in a minute. He goes out there and dumps millions in hospitality stocks like casinos and hotels, things like that. Things that you could say would go down in a place where people are like, hey, you know where we should go while coronavirus is raging? Let's go to the casino and waste money that we don't have when we're begging the government for a stimulus and be in a closed quarters environment with lots of cigarette smoke and people in wheelchairs and generally old people. You go to a typical casino, half the people are looking at slot machines through oxygen masks, right? Like there's a lot of old people there. So about the last place you'd want to be, dumps millions in casino stocks and buys healthcare stocks, which are probably going to go up under this crisis and everything. So that's definitely insider trading. There's no way you can argue that's not. But the problem with that one sentence seat is it looks like the likely candidate against Loeffler is going to be this guy, Ralph Warnock, Reverend and pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church. I don't personally know much about him. I'm not going to claim to be that familiar with him. But again, it kind of falls under my thing about, well, Tupperville is a Auburn football coach. What qualifies him to be in the Senate? Well, what qualifies somebody who's the reverend and pastor of a big mega church in Atlanta to be in the Senate? And not the strongest candidate that you could point to and look at. And a lot of really strong candidates like Stacey Abrams, Jimmy Carter's grandson, Jason Carter, and Sally Yates, they've all declined to run for the Senate seat, which is kind of confusing to me personally. And then two of the better candidates are over on the other side running against David Perdue, who is an incumbent, who has been elected. And you have John Ossoff and Teresa Tomlinson, I might say genuinely better candidates, who are running against him. David Perdue, they're saying he did the same thing that Loeffler did, maybe not on the scale that she did, but he also did a little bit of insider trading and dumped some stocks right when he got briefed on this. But either way, you've got John Ossoff. He's the guy that he ran for that 6th congressional district to Georgia back in 2017, and he had all this support and all this money. He was kind of like Beto O'Rourke Rourke before Beto, right? Everybody thought he was going to be the next big thing, and then he lost. But he still probably would have been a good candidate against Loeffler. But then you have Teresa Tomlinson, the former mayor of Columbus, who also seems like a pretty good candidate. And then they're kind of running against each other, which it's going to be one of them, which makes no sense, against David Perdue, who's an incumbent and therefore stronger and less likely to beat than either Loeffler or Doug Collins. I kind of wish you could flip that race around and change it a little bit. But I still think looking pretty promising, and more so every day, depending on exactly what happens. Then you go down to Idaho and you got Jim Risch. He's going to win, so fuck that shit. Then you go down to Illinois and you got Dick Durbin. He's a Democrat. He's going to be reelected, which is good news. Then you have Iowa. Our old buddy Joni Ernst. Now, for those that aren't familiar, Joni Ernst is, I believe she was the only woman that Trump vetted to be his VP in 2016, the only woman he even considered. She's a strong Trump backer. You might think, well, how come we don't know who the Democratic candidate is going to be against Joni Ernst? How come we don't know who's going to be facing her? Because Iowa was the first state in the country to vote. But this is what makes even less sense about the Iowa caucus. Even though the Iowa caucus went first in the nation and we have their results, I say their results as though it didn't take them a week to tell us who actually won that thing, but we have their results back in February. Their Senate primary is not until June the 2nd. So you got to wait all the way till June 2nd to see which Democrat is going to be facing Joni Ernst. Then you got Michael T. Franken, who's a retired U.S. Navy Admiral, was an aide to Ted Kennedy when Ted Kennedy was alive. You got Teresa Greenfield, who was a candidate for the 3rd Congressional District in 2018. And you got Eddie Morrow, another candidate who lost the 3rd Congressional District in 2018. Not looking like the cream of the crop, so to speak. Anyway, we'll see who gets to face her, but that's one of those seats that definitely could be won if a candidate is right. But right now, I would say Joni Ernst would be reelected, which kind of sucks because I'd like to see her out the door or whatever. But then you go down to Kansas and you have Pat Roberts, and he's retiring, so that makes Kansas more likely to flip than if he were running for re-election. This is another seat where a Republican is retiring in a presidential election year with a popular Democratic presidential candidate, and could definitely be easy to flip, but the candidates aren't that great that are running for this Senate seat on the Democratic side. A lot of people that I've never really heard of. Again, Robert Tillman, nominee for 4th Congressional District in 2012 and candidate in 2016 and 2017. That just sounds like one of those perennial losers, you know, somebody that runs and they don't care what it's for. They just want to run and then they're always losing and then they keep running again. So obviously that's not very exciting. Then you have Barbara Bollier. I may be pronouncing that wrong, but Bollier, who's a state senator. Maybe she'll get it. It seems like she has a ton of endorsements compared to anybody else. But either way, you know, you kind of wish you were getting somebody who was a little bit more of a heavy hitter, like Catherine Sebelius. She was the former governor of Kansas. Obama picked her to be Health and Human Services Secretary and lead the effort for Obamacare. Now that Obamacare, at the time, very unpopular in Kansas and other places, now I think people realize how necessary it was and how important it was. So that becomes more popular every day. She'd be an excellent candidate for the Senate race, but she's not running. Then you go down to Kentucky, where you have Mitch McConnell. And would this not be the ultimate victory? I mean, if you could get McConnell out, the prospect is saying that, I don't mean to gross you out, this is too much information, but I'm almost getting hard. My pants are getting tight just thinking about getting McConnell out of there. That would almost be sweeter than Trump. In a way, it would almost be as sweet as Trump, maybe even sweeter, because McConnell is such a recurring bastard. I mean, everybody kind of looks at Trump as a temporary problem. One very, very unpopular, stupid, incompetent, dangerous one-term president who's a fucking idiot. And even once he's out of the office, he'll still shoot his mouth off. But every day, it's the law of diminishing marginal utility. The more Trump you get, the less you want. Law of diminishing marginal utility basically says, if I eat two pizzas on a single day, I'm going to enjoy that less than if I have one pizza on Monday and one pizza on Friday, right? You'll just enjoy that a lot more than eating a lot of it at once. He almost does better when he totally disappears for a few days. I look at Trump as a little bit of a temporary problem. Once he's out of office, he can talk all the crazy shit he wants to on Twitter. People should grab their guns and take to the streets. They're not going to do that. And I'm going to tell you right now, and we'll eventually have an episode about, is America headed for civil war? A lot of these Trump folks, they're all fucking talk. A lot of these people are cowards. They have their AK-47s and their bullshit MAGA hats and their hatred and all this stuff. They fight people who won't fight back. If they ever encounter somebody who fights back, they almost immediately run away or say something else. They're only strong when there's like 10 of them and there's one of you. But if it's ever a one-on-one individual fight, and I'm talking about intellectually, physically, they run from those kind of fights. They like fights where it's 10 of them screaming Fredo at Chris Cuomo or something like that. But if he gets in their face and stands up to them, Joe Biden, you saw him do this in the Michigan auto plant where that one guy was saying he's going to take all the AK-47s away. And look, I'm a lot more pro-gun than Joe Biden is. I don't necessarily agree with Joe Biden about guns. But that was good to watch him stand up to somebody. He saw the gun nut basically being like, yeah, you're going to take our guns away. You're this and that. And Joe Biden says, that's bullshit. And he sticks his finger in the guy's face. Less than a minute later, the guy's like, your finger in my face, that's not okay. He looked afraid of Joe Biden. Joe Biden's a 77-year-old man. That guy was a young man in the height of his physicality. He had a beard. I thought he's a typical gun nut wimp. I'm sorry, but a pussy. But he's got all these guns and he thinks that makes him a tough guy. Get all these guys like that that collect these guns, they hide behind their masculinity, like, hey, it's all Joe Rogan's podcast and beer and guns and everything else. And then when somebody really stands up to him and gets in their face, they run away almost immediately. He's afraid of a 77-year-old man sticking his finger in his face. I thought he's just another gun nut wimp hiding behind guns to look strong. And that's a lot of Trump people. If it's one-on-one and you get in their face, they won't fight you. They'll run away. On Twitter and social media, Trump people try to start fights with me, and the second you push back or fight back a little bit, they run away. They hide. Now, Bernie Sanders people, they'll keep shit going till the fucking earth crashes into the sun. I mean, they don't have jobs. They don't care. They just want to keep stuff going. But a lot of Trump people, they'll disappear eventually. When you get to Kentucky, or, you know, I don't know exactly who the candidate will be for the Democratic side, but I just hope it's somebody that can beat Mitch McConnell, because good Lord almighty, that would be sweet. Oh, that would be sweet as strawberries. And it's not unheard of for a Senate majority leader to lose. Tom Daschle did. Tom Daschle in South Dakota for the Democratic side, he eventually lost and got beat. So it's not impossible. No matter how big and how powerful it is, if your constituents don't like what you're doing, and I'm thinking McConnell's constituents sent him a loud and clear message. They didn't really approve of the way he was handling the pandemic, and they need those stimulus checks. I mean, Kentucky is not a wealthy state. When you look at states in terms of best standard of living to worst standard of living, Kentucky is routinely near the bottom. So actually, they probably really need this money. And so for McConnell, who's lived in Washington, D.C. for 30, 40 years and probably doesn't really spend that much time in Kentucky and is married to a woman who's Trump's transportation secretary, so she's very protected because she's part of his cabinet. He's not connected necessarily to the way that a lot of people in Kentucky live. And they were probably like, hey, you know what? Fuck this guy. So, I mean, I think that's why you saw that urgency. But I love this. It went from a safe R rating to a likely R. A likely R, that can easily flip to leans R. And leans R could easily flip to toss-up. And if you can get it to a toss-up, a Democrat can beat him. You have Bill Cassidy, another Republican in a very safe district, so that's boring. I'm not going to spend time on that. Then you go down to Maine, and then you have Susan Collins. And Susan Collins, I think this would be very sweet. Only a few weeks before the coronavirus happened, she had to defend her vote not to impeach Trump by saying, he's learned his lesson. Trump is a changed man. Trump knows he did wrong, and I think he's going to... 2 days later, literally giving a press conference where he looks like Tony Soprano. He's like the rats, the stool pigeons. He's talking about getting revenge. He's talking about, you know, calling people animals and garbage and things like that. I mean, he looked like a vindictive mobster. He looked like Al Capone being like, we got to have him whacked. I want his family whacked. I want his dog whacked. I want his house burned to the ground and the ashes pissed on. He's threatening people. He looks like a gangster. And you look at him and you think, this is exactly how and authoritarians and dictatorships and aspiring tyrants, this is how they see the opposition, as people that humiliated them. And it's not about checks and balances and the laws and right and wrong. It's just they're personally humiliating him and he's obsessed with getting back at them. He needs to get back at them somehow, some way. So this is exactly how authoritarians think. So her saying that he's learned his lesson, he's done better, this and that, and then 2 days later proves her wrong. And then you see some of the votes that she's cast in the past that are now looking very, very badly in terms of the coronavirus epidemic. And you're also seeing the fact, every day that he fucks up, she's now inextricably tied in a way that a lot of other senators are not, quite frankly. Like, I mean, a lot of other senators are not necessarily like, every Republican is responsible for Trump's bad behavior. We kind of like to hand that around Susan Collins, because that was one of the people, because she's a moderate, and because she's in a state that leans blue, and it would have been politically pretty safe for her to oppose some of this stuff. She could have opposed Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. She could have stopped that single-handedly, and she didn't. She could have helped vote out Trump. She could have stood with Mitt Romney, and maybe a couple of others would have been inspired to. She's in a state where going against Trump is not really that unpopular. I mean, like I said, Maine leans blue. It's really not Trump country. She's up for a re-election this year. The fact that she hasn't, and the fact that she's routinely listed as a moderate, as some kind of John McCain, Mitt Romney style style maverick or moderate of the Republican Party, even though she's not. Even though we don't really see her do anything that moderate. We see the Hamlet routine, like, I'm so tortured, I don't know what I'm going to do. And a lot of other people who did that shit, Bob Corker and Jeff Flake, they all resigned. They all got the hell out of Dodge and left because they just couldn't really stay in the Senate and be that way. Susan Collins has chosen to embrace Trump, and now she's going to deal with the fallout from that. And I honestly, out of any of the senators on the Republican side whose seats might flip, I think she's the most likely. Arizona's the second most likely, and Cory Gardner in Colorado is the third most likely. Then you go down, you got Massachusetts, Michigan, and Minnesota. Ed Markey, Gary Peters, and Tina Smith, they're all Democrats, and they're all likely to be reelected. I feel pretty confident that they'll be reelected. You go down to Mississippi, Alabama's scary cousin. And in Mississippi, you have Cindy Hyde-Smith. She's running for reelection. Could she lose? People say, well, Mississippi, could that be the next Alabama? Could you have an unpopular candidate like Cindy Hyde-Smith, who's an incumbent but under some strange circumstances, and she's running against Mike Espy, a guy who just barely lost in 2018. So in 2018, you had a close race between him and Hyde-Smith, a lot closer than people thought it would be. And so could Mike Espy, could he beat her now? Because 2018, that's a special election, that's a midterm. Typically, you don't get sky-high minority turnout and young turnout, and a lot of the people that vote for Democrats. Could 2020 be different, especially with Joe Biden, who's extremely popular in Mississippi, and black voters and rural voters and older voters? Could this be his year? Probably not, but people said the same thing about Doug Jones in 2017, and I said Doug Jones would win, and he did win. I don't think it's as locked as people think. And if national Democrats, if they'll give Mike Espy's campaign some money, that's the thing about Southern Democrats, because a lot of the national Democrats, they write us off. They say, oh, it's better to give Kirsten Gillibrand a $1 million check, even though she's, of course, going to be reelected and there's no real competition for her, than to actually invest some money in these very close Southern races that actually are a lot closer than people think if you really look at them. If he can get some money to actually really run a race against her, then that would be pretty damn great. Same thing for Montana. You have Steve Daines, who's a, I would say, lukewarm incumbent, not the most popular incumbent in the world, going to be running against Steve Bullock. Steve Bullock, a little bit like John Hickenlooper, except I like Steve Bullock a lot more. But Steve Bullock ran for president last year. He eventually had to drop out of the race, and now he's running for the Senate seat in Montana. Same thing that John Hickenlooper running for Senate seat in Colorado is doing. Now, Steve Bullock, I like him more than Hickenlooper because I believe that he's a lot better advocate for things I care about. He's been fantastic on net neutrality, keeping dark money out of politics. There's a documentary called Dark Money that I would strongly encourage people to watch. I believe it came out in 2018, but it's a PBS documentary, and it's fantastic. It's really about Montana and how a lot of dark money is seeping into that. He's interviewed at the time. He's the attorney general for Montana. He was that before he became governor, but he was one of the first ones leading the crusade about, like, hey, for a Montana governor's race, why is there all this out-of-state money flooding into this and everything? And of course, the reason is because you get the right governor in there and the right state legislature, and then Alec can get all these crazy right-wing bills passed through one state, and then they can just do whatever they want to in that one state, and then that becomes a template for the rest of America, and they can try to spread that out. But if you can get a lot of very, very favorable business laws passed, and it could be Alabama, it could be Montana, it could be Idaho, then you can start to really get away with murder in these states. You can do more and more stuff, and then you start to move the conversation more and more to the right. And then by that time, it's almost like you do the red states, and then you can come for the purple states, and then the soft blue states, and then it's almost like put some dork like Grover Norquist or Steve Moore or whoever out there, and they'll be like, well, Colorado, they're losing money because a CEO can't shoot one of his workers, but he can in Nebraska, so that's helped Nebraska's tax returns by 5%. They'll fudge the numbers whenever they can to make that look like a better deal than it really is. So Bullitt's one of the first people talking about this. He's running for the Senate race. I would love to have him in the Senate because he's fantastic. Even if he loses that race, I think Joe Biden should look at him for a cabinet position. Let's say Kamala Harris is Joe Biden's vice president, which I think she should be. Steve Bullock is a great candidate for attorney general because he'll really go after some of the dark money, some of the business interest and things that people think he's very friendly to that he's a centrist Democrat. He's not really. He's actually more liberal than a lot of people may realize. And I probably shouldn't say that because Montana might hear that and not vote for him. I think he would be an excellent attorney general. I think in his heart of hearts, he's a lot more liberal than John Hickenlooper and some of the others were that were labeled centrist. Then you go down to Nebraska and you get Ben Sasse, that son of a bitch that everybody thinks is moderate, but he's not really. And he's running for re-election and he'll probably win, and it's Nebraska and who gives a shit. Then you go down to New Hampshire and you have Jeannie Shaheen, who's running for re-election, likely to be re-elected. I mean, it's not exactly as safe as some of the other Democrats. In my opinion, she's probably the most vulnerable aside from Doug Jones. But either way, I do think she'll be re-elected. Then you go down to New Jersey and you have Cory Booker, very, very safe re-election. Cory Booker's been one of the few senators who's actually popular right now, so I think that's pretty safe. Then you go down to New Mexico. You have Tom Udall, who's a Democrat, but he's retiring. But I think New Mexico, which is leaning blue and more blue every day, and especially in a race against Biden versus Trump, be more likely than not to have a Democrat hang on to that. It could be closer than people think, but I'm hoping that Democrats can pull it out. Then you go down to North Carolina and you have Tom Tillis. You've heard me say multiple times that we don't need to just flip three, we really need to flip four. And I think most people think the most likely will be Tom Tillis, because in North Carolina you have a pretty good candidate in Cunningham. He won their Democratic primary. Now Mitch McConnell and the Republicans tried to pull something sneaky. They encouraged people to vote for Erica Smith, who's one of these Bernie-backed ultra-liberal candidates in a state like North Carolina where they knew she would lose, so his super PAC was giving her money, knowing that she'd be easier for Tom Tillis to beat in the general election. But luckily, North Carolinians didn't fall for it, and they voted for Cunningham. Tom Tillis clearly does not want to run against Cunningham. In general, in politics, always pick the candidate that the person does not want to run against. That's the person that you should pick in your primary. That's a very close race, and that's a toss-up. And that's very good, because North Carolina, if they have a Democratic governor, you're going to have a little bit more access to voting machines and things like that. The election's going to be a little bit more fair than it will be in a state like Texas, where they're totally manipulating the results and things like that. I'm optimistic out of the fourth seat that we need. I think it's going to come from the Southeast. If not Georgia, then North Carolina. And I'm thinking that it's going to come from the Southeast in some form or fashion. And I'm really hoping that it will. My hope is to have a lot of it come from the Southeast, with McConnell, fucking Lindsey Graham, and John Cornyn in Texas, all of them voted out. But even if that doesn't happen, I'm thinking North Carolina is going to be where the fourth one comes from. Then you go down to Oklahoma, you have Jim Inhofe, and even though he sucks, he's probably one of the worst. If you had to say the top five worst senators, other than Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul, it may very well be Jim Inhofe. He'd be in my top five for sure, maybe fourth or fifth at the very least. Doesn't believe in climate crisis, basically is a theocrat, doesn't think the world will end until God is ready for it to end. I mean, one of the most ignorant men you could imagine being in the Senate. And he just got caught up in the insider trading scandal. I mean, he's right there with Richard Burr and Kelly Inhofe and David Perdue, but he's running for a re-election in Oklahoma, and they seem to love him for some strange reason. And Oklahoma's famously Republican, radically Republican, one of the most Republican states in America. I mean, even Tulsa, Oklahoma and Oklahoma City, their two biggest cities, they had Republican mayors. Usually when you see a red state, a very red state like Alabama, the mayor of Birmingham will be a Democrat. That's not true for Tulsa and Oklahoma City. So Oklahoma is probably the most Republican state in America. It would be almost impossible for Jim Inhofe to lose that seat. Even their native daughter, you could say Elizabeth Warren, who's from Oklahoma, she came in fourth in the Oklahoma Democratic primary. Not a lot of reasons to be optimistic there, even though I'd love for him to get out. Oregon and Rhode Island, you have Jeff Merkley and Jack Reed. They're safe seats. That's probably going to happen for them. And that's good, because they're Democrat. Then you got South Carolina. I've already talked about Lindsey Graham a little bit against Jamie Harrison. And I'm hoping against hope Jamie Harrison can pull one out. It looks better every day. 3 months ago, I said there's no way Lindsey Graham could get beat. But as Joy Reid pointed out, he's not invincible. He's not invulnerable. When he wins his races, it's not 75-25. I mean, it's usually like 55-45. I mean, it's only a few points difference, really. And if you have a good candidate, and I believe Harrison is, and you have Graham handling this virus the wrong way, which I believe he is, a lot of his popular friends, John McCain is dead and everything. I mean, more and more, it looks like he's kind of alone in the Senate in terms of a lot of the old school establishment Republicans. John McCain is dead. Mitt Romney's not a Trump lover. I mean, a lot of these people have abandoned him. Jeff Sessions could very well lose the runoff. He's got fewer friends every day in the Republican branch of the Senate. A lot of the new school people don't necessarily like him. The funny thing is, he's considered a moderate to some of these people who are Tea Party lunatics. I mean, he's looking more endangered every day. And if there was ever going to be a year that he would lose, it would be this year, where Joe Biden is the Democratic nominee and extremely popular in South Carolina. And that's going to inspire a lot of turnout for Jamie Harrison, who Jim Clyburn and some others in South Carolina, they've already said, Joe, you got to really come out for Jamie. And he's going to. Biden's not afraid to go into a state and have rallies and do things like that and campaign for the Senate. Not shy about doing that. He helped Doug Jones in that way in Alabama. So that could be interesting. Then you go down to South Dakota, Mike Rounds, Republican, another boring Republican in a safe seat. Then you go down to Tennessee. And even though Lamar Alexander is retiring, so you'd think this could be a very easy seat to flip. Tennessee, Nashville is getting bigger every day. Nashville has only got about 20,000 fewer people than Boston does. So Nashville is getting bigger and bigger in terms of being a Democratic city. Memphis is a huge city in the Southeast, also Democratic. Memphis and Nashville and Knoxville alone could flip Tennessee from red to purple. But the Democrats don't have a very good candidate running in Tennessee for their Senate seat. So that's kind of surprising to me that they couldn't find somebody really good to run for this seat that seems like it could be a win. I'm not optimistic that that one will flip, even though it should. I mean, if you just look at the demographics of how the state's changing and everything else, I mean, it kind of doesn't make sense that they couldn't find a better candidate to run. In Texas, you have John Cornyn. His response to the coronavirus has been pretty atrocious. But unfortunately, 2018 made Democrats very afraid. 2018, you had Beto O'Rourke ran the most expensive Senate campaign in history. Nobody has run as expensive as he has and lost. And he ran against Ted Cruz, a guy who many people hate. I saw where Ted Cruz was going to have to be self-isolated for 2 weeks, and they showed footage of the Senate applauding, and they're like, yay, Ted Cruz is gone. They had confetti. They had a whole fucking party. They had a fuck you Ted Cruz sheet cake out there, and everybody ate a piece. Lindsey Graham himself said if you killed Ted Cruz on the Senate floor, nobody would convict you, because that's just how hated he is, basically. He compared voting to Cruz or Trump. Do you want to die by stabbing or shooting? Ted Cruz is not the most popular member of the Senate, let's put it that way. And yet Beto O'Rourke, a charismatic young dude with more money than anybody's ever had, couldn't beat out Ted Cruz. And so I think that's going to make people afraid to really spend a lot of money in Texas and help the Democratic challenger there against John Cornyn. I wish that weren't true, because I do believe this is a state that could flip. If this were a midterm year, Doug Jones would not be reelected. Like, there's no way. But a presidential election year, turnout is a lot better. Turnout's going to be sky high among people who don't like Trump and want to get rid of him. And there's a lot of people who generally like Joe Biden. His turnout in this Democratic primary has been way better than Hillary's was in 2016. It's been almost as good as the 2008 turnout when Hillary and Obama were driving it sky high. If there was a year to flip the Texas Senate race, it would be this year. I'm just afraid that Democrats will be very conservative in their spending on that particular race, and that's not good. Then in Virginia, you have Mark Warner, who's probably going to be reelected. It looks better for him every single day. Mark Warner, if you see some of my YouTube videos, I said that a perfect 2020 ticket would be Kamala Harris as the nominee and Mark Warner as vice president. I think they could have wiped the floor with Trump. I really do. Mark Warner is a sane, established Democrat. I'm not using that the way Bernie people do. They say establishment, they mean it bad. I say established, meaning he's got experience, he's qualified, he's well-known, he's well-liked, his foreign policy credentials are pretty good, he's sat on a lot of committees, he generally knows what's happening in the world. Established means, yeah, we would hire him for the job. I think he'll be reelected, and if this were a slightly different year, I would say that him being Kamala Harris's VP would be very exciting. Then you have in West Virginia, Shelley Moore Capito, going to be reelected. Who gives a shit? Who cares? Then Wyoming, like I said, safe Republican seat. But going back and looking at all these, I mean, you can see a lot of reasons to be hopeful. If you had to put a gun in my head, say Alabama Liberal, you famous predictor of things come to pass. Sometimes you read Alabama Liberal and you see that an article I wrote today is tomorrow's headlines. You said Alabama Liberal, what's going to happen with the Senate? I would say today, things could change radically because of the, Mark Cuban called the coronavirus a black swan event, meaning that things change so rapidly, there's no way to really know how things will change. I would say today, the Democrats will flip the Senate. In order of most likely, Maine, Arizona, Colorado, and North Carolina. Hopefully, if there is a fifth seat that gets flipped, I'd love to say Lindsey Graham and John Cornyn and Mitch McConnell, but most likely I think it'll come from Georgia. My prediction is they will flip five seats and possibly lose Doug Jones's seat, would be my prediction if I had to make one today. We'll see what happens. But I'm 65% in on them flipping the Senate, and I'm about 51% in on it being five seats, and then maybe minus Doug Jones. And interesting things. Thanks for listening, everybody. Hope you're staying safe. Please remember to wash your hands constantly. Wear a face mask if you're forced to go out and buy groceries. If you're not like me and you don't have a 2-year supply of chili in your house, you'll eventually have to buy groceries. Make sure you wear a face mask. Don't talk to anybody you don't have to. Wash your hands the second you get home. Remember to wash your doorknobs. In your own house, your outside doorknob has a shitload of germs on it. People may forget about that. Anyway, maybe I'll do some more coronavirus tips in 61. Not like we're going anywhere. California's going to be locked down for at least a month. So there could very well be 10 episodes in 2 weeks. Who knows? I mean, I may get really bored. But thanks for listening, everybody. I appreciate your time. Stay tuned for episode 61 coming up shortly.